Good to have a teammate from Grace Church with me tonight. Feel like I'm home. Well, take your Bible, join me in James chapter 1. As we consider one of the most relevant truths, perspectives, practices for a Christian. 15 years ago, my family's life changed. My 13-year-old son, who was full of life and vigor, motorcycles, dirt bikes, football, active in our church, the life of the party, lots of fun, good guy, my favorite guy, became a shadow of himself. He went from the fastest and the strongest, most energetic, to someone who found it difficult to do anything for any length of time. Sleep was hard, pain in the joints, fog in the mind. He would have a variety of symptoms that sent us on a journey of 40 to 50 caregivers, doctors, and people with capacity to help. I'm in Birmingham. The UAB Medical Center was there, regional teaching hospital. The dean of the medical school was in my church. It was not like I didn't have help, but it was futile. We couldn't figure out what was going on, what was happening to him. And 3 years into that arduous journey, he left school halfway through the ninth grade because he couldn't continue. About 3 years into it, he was diagnosed with Lyme disease. And in my part of the country, in Alabama, at that time, there wasn't much known about Lyme disease. To find someone who could diagnose it, which is not easy, test isn't horribly or significantly reliable, there's not a lot of familiarity, at least at that time. And it took a doctor from the New England area. I had separated a shoulder. I went for a follow-up treatment, and she had trained in the northeastern corridor, and my son had happened to go to the treatment with me, and somehow we began in the providence of God to talk about his journey, and she began to talk to him and not me. And after several minutes of inquiry and questions, she said, you have Lyme disease. She said, I had it. I know the symptoms of it. You present with all of them. Did you ever have a target type bite on your body? Yes, I did. We thought it was a spider bite. We just didn't think about deer ticks and the impact that they can bring, life-changing impact. Learned since then that Lyme is the third largest infectious disease in the world behind AIDS and malaria. So it's a thing, and you may have it here in Texas. We certainly have it in California because I talk about this periodically. I am aware of the fact that our family's not alone in that struggle. You spend an enormous amount of money trying to find a solution, and you know, it's good-hearted people trying to help you, doctors that are trained but don't know exactly what to do. And when you get deep into it, you have chronic late-stage Lyme, which if you don't discover it until later, it can be more of a lifelong thing. Chronic late-stage Lyme is typically not healable. You just manage it. Lyme, if you get it and understand you have it, it's a simple antibiotic treatment for a couple of weeks, and you're good to go. We didn't get that benefit, and therefore, our life has changed. My son is 28 years old. He lives above the garage with his wife. It's amazing to me that God would give my son a wife, since he can't work, since every day is a struggle. God does what God does, and he changes your circumstances in ways you couldn't imagine. And my message tonight is not about me, because my trouble and my challenge, which still goes on, we will be moving to Tennessee, and my son and daughter-in-law will move with us because I'm the provider. Your situation may be different. Job says it this way, Job 14:1, man who is born of woman is a few days and full of trouble. Someone has said you're either in trouble, just getting out of trouble, or about to get into trouble. There's all kinds of trials. There's all kinds of situations. And this passage that I want to teach you tonight has been an anchor for our family. And frankly, it's an important anchor for a Christian because the book of James, the oldest one in the New Testament by way of time, it's in the early 50s. Church wasn't found but a few years before. James is the half-brother of Jesus Christ. He was not a believer until he saw the resurrected Christ. He becomes converted and he becomes the chief spokesman at the chief church in the entire known world, Jerusalem. If you read Acts 15, when the discussion was had as to whether you needed to be circumcised or keep the law of Moses in order to be saved, Peter led the discussion, but James concluded the discussion, implying that he was the formidable leader, decider, senior pastor, if you will, at the first Bible church of Jerusalem. This book is written to Hebrew Christians, converts, born again, Pentecost, the early preaching of Peter, the work of the gospel. And because of persecution, the church has been dispersed all over Asia Minor, all over the known world. And James writes this letter early to the early Christians who have been persecuted and fled for their life and safety in order to correct their perspective of what real Christianity ought to look like. The assumption is that the reason he wrote this letter is because he was hearing things back that were inconsistent with true faith. So he pens a letter, 5 chapters, fundamentally governed by imperatives, things you need to do or not do. It's prophetic in that sense. It's pastoral. The word brother or brethren is used many, many times. It's soft in its language, but it's strong in its prescriptions. And presumably, he's hearing that the claim of Christ, the claim of faith, was not being validated by the reality of life. You say you have faith, but you don't have works. That faith is dead. If you say you have it and you don't display it, it has no value. So these 5 chapters are populated with perspectives as to what the lifestyle and the convictions of a real Christian should include. Saving faith works. That's his big argument. It validates its reality by what it does. Works do not save you. For by grace are we saved through faith. It is the work of God, not our work, lest we should boast. God does what people can't do. The dead can do nothing. We're dead in our trespasses and sins. But through the mercy of God, though we were slaves to sin, that we were impotent to be pleasing to God, God in his mercy and his love saves us. By grace, to be a new creation, to live differently, and the way we live validates that reality. Because saving faith always works, or it's not saving. And there is a kind of belief that's not believing. So James is writing to help the people of God wherever they are to have the lifestyle and convictions of biblical faith, the faith that saves. So this book is about how genuine faith works, the proofs, if you will, of genuine and saving faith, the faith and conduct that your life is measured by. The work of the gospel is not just transformational to you, it's influential to others. Which is why verse 1, James writes, I'm a bondservant or a slave, doulos, of God and of the Lord Jesus Christ, and I'm writing to the 12 tribes who are diaspora. dispersed. Spora is seed. Dia is out. Sown like seeds of the gospel into the world. How? By persecution. And he's going to begin by talking about how to deal with difficulty, the trials that go with being a Christian. Because when life is hard, you can abandon your faith and compromise your faith. Because when life is hard, it's hard to live life. So you want to neutralize the hard. You want to numb it. You want to be distracted. And you end up making choices that are not productive and are contradictory to the gospel claim you're making. So James, I believe, begins to write about how to deal with difficulty. He deals with external difficulty. That's what we're going to talk about tonight. Then he's going to talk about material difficulty, the kind when you have a lot and the trial that having a lot is, because having a lot is a test and a trial too, and having too little is a trial also. And then he talks about inward trouble, temptation, where it comes from, where it originates, how it works. So he starts with outward trouble, verses 1 through 8. Material trouble, 8, 10, and 11. And then with 13 through 15, he talks about inward trouble, temptation. And he concludes, verse 16, don't be deceived, my beloved brethren. We're going to look at the first 8 verses tonight because our subject is dealing with difficulty, triumphing in trouble, being successful when you're suffering. And the key to success and triumph, living as a Christian in a way that honors the Lord, is rooted in behaving and responding to the challenges you face in recognition. Here's the 3 key thoughts. Recognition of what it is, your trial. You see it for what it is. 2, you see God for who He is. And you see yourself for who you are. The key to triumphing in trouble, making good out of not good, dealing with difficulty, which a Christian should do differently than the world does it, is determined by how you view your trouble, seeing it for what it is, seeing God for who He is, and seeing yourself for who you are. So he begins in verse 2 with what a Christian needs to do when it's hard, when trouble happens. Verse 2, consider it all joy, my brethren, when you fall or encounter various trials. The word consider is an imperative verb. It's an aggressive imperative verb, which means it's an immediate decision point driven by a conviction. When something happens, when trouble happens, parapipto, when troubles fall around you, when it's raining trouble, what do? James starts with a declaration that what a Christian does and what genuine faith must do is determine and regard and consider as a conviction of the heart, to willfully regard what is happening as a cause for joy. In other words, he says you need to consider this good. The very first thought that needs to happen in order for you to be successful in expressing your faith is to recognize this is an opportunity for good. It's a difficulty, which means it's not easy. This is not about pain. This is about potential. This is about recognizing as a willful, from the heart, anchor of conviction, this is good. And I'm going to call it a cause for joy. Now, I want you to notice the word all joy. Do you see the word all? It's emphatic. It starts the sentence in the original language. Greek has a way of prioritizing and emphasizing words. And one of the ways you will emphasize a word is to put it at the front, the primary position, to say this is important. And the secondary is at the end. So you say it at the beginning or you say it at the end, but what you're calling attention to is, this is what I want you to know, and this matters. The first verb is to consider it, to recognize it, to deem it as an act of your will, to exercise your will first and foremost to say, this is good. Number two, to consider it so good, it's a cause for joy at the highest level. It's all joy. Now, that is alien to everything in our humanity. When troubles come relationally, when troubles come financially, when troubles come physically, when troubles come, alien to our humanity is go, this is great. And this says it's so great, it's all joy. We had a daughter first out in California before we moved back to Birmingham, where I pastored a church for 27 years, and Wendy was born in Santa Clarita, and we moved back. She was raised in Alabama. And 7 years later, after a couple of miscarriages, Karen was pregnant with our second child, and we went to the Brookwood Hospital in Birmingham, and we did what many couples do. Some want to be surprised. I did not want to be surprised. And so we went into the ultrasound area, and the gal was doing what ultrasound people do, and I'm standing there watching and listening, and she said, oh, wow, you're going to have a boy. Now, listen, it was undeniable. Sometimes it's not clear, but it was clear that I was going to have a boy. She showed me. I saw it. I'm Harry Freese Walls III. There's a first Harry and a second Harry, my father and grandfather. I'm not particularly enthralled with the name Harry, even though there's a prince named Harry. What I am excited about is the guys who carried that name before I did, because of who they were, the honor they displayed. I like my name not because it's cool, but because of who carried it. And I got to the parking lot at the Brookwood Hospital. I walked onto the deck with my wife, and I did both arms raised, a woo-hoo that I'm not going to do tonight because I'm mic'd. But I wouldn't have needed a microphone. Everybody in the parking deck would have known something good had just happened. You know what that is? Arm raised, all joy. It might be tears coming down your cheeks, joy. I performed I don't know how many weddings. One of my favorite things is when she's walking down the aisle and I look at the groom and tears running out of their eyes just because of the beauty and the wonder of that moment. This is that kind of joy. This is what needs to happen. Well, how in the world can that happen? Only if you understand what it is that is happening to you. And what James does is to help us understand why we can do what God is asking Christians to do, to consider it all joy, brothers, my brothers, when you encounter various trials. The word various is many colored, all kinds. It's not about the kind of trouble. My trouble, I explained, but that's mine. And mine isn't harder than yours. Mine is different than yours. This is not about kind or severity. It's about trouble. And it doesn't matter what color it is, what it dresses itself up as. The first thing you do, James says, is you go, this is good. And it's so good, I have joy and I'm expressing that joy. Now, why is that? Verse 3 begins with a word which modifies the verb. The verb is consider. The modifying word, a participle, is because. Because you know. Now, the know is not propositional. It's not like you read it in a book. Because it's a conviction and an experience that you have in your heart. It is personal knowledge that I've embraced. This is something I know like gravity. If I climb up on the roof and I jump off, I know I'm going down. I am not flying. It is that kind of knowledge. I know this to be true. He's saying, because you know, and this is a present tense. It's like I always know I'm never going to abandon this conviction. I'm never going to be on the roof and think, oh, I'm going to fly today. Because I know gravity's at work, and I know it. Because I know that we know that the testing of our faith produces endurance. You've got to see it for what it is. And I'm going to give you the six things right out of the gate, and then we'll work through why it's true. The way you maximize difficulty, triumph in trouble, extract good out of not good, however you like to say it, is you need to see it for what it is. So what is it? Number one, it's a test to reveal. To reveal the authenticity of our faith, to reveal the quality of our faith, the needs for our faith. It's a test to reveal. It's to an exercise to strengthen our faith. It's a tool to train us in our faith, to refine our faith. It's a time to reach people with the gospel. It's a stage to display the greatness of God. And it's a table where we can taste the richness of God. Verse 3 says, testing, it's a test. It's a test that reveals. That's what tests do. It's used to test the quality of metals. It's used to test the strength of things. One of the realities that makes this a positive experience is it's an opportunity to learn something about your faith, whether you have it or you don't, and where your faith needs to be strengthened. I had a lawyer in my church in Birmingham who had a 15-month-old son, and they lived not far from our church, and the little boy somehow found his way to the stairs down to the garage, three steps down, a little landing, and then some more steps to the garage area, and somehow he got through that door. He tumbled and fell and broke his neck in those first three steps. And when I got to the hospital, the UAB Medical Center downtown, mom and dad were there, and there's their little boy who looks like he's sleeping, but he's not sleeping. He's on machinery to keep him alive. It was a hard, hard season. What unfolded, I buried that little boy, attempted to minister to those parents, but the lawyer father never recovered. His solution to his situation was to disconnect, isolate, and drink. It wasn't too long. And I met with him and tried to encourage him and support him as a brother would a brother. Who can describe how horrific the loss of your son would be? It wasn't about how hard it was. It was about what he did in response to how hard it was. What ended up happening is he left his wife, he left the church, he left his testimony because he couldn't handle what God had done. I don't want a God like that. Now, you may know someone like that. You may be tempted to be someone like that. But the test and the trials of your faith reveal whether you have it or you don't. They validate it. And they also reveal, even if you have it, where you're not strong but need to be strengthened. There's a fitness center at the university. I only live a block and a half from the university, and so I frequent the fitness center because I need it. And I have a basic routine I've done for a long, long time, and I've discovered that planks are better than sit-ups. And if you don't know what a plank is, you get on your elbows and you flatten your back and you hold that position as long as you can as an abdominal exercise. And I'm pretty good at it. I can hold it for nearly 2 minutes. That's good. The world record is like 9 hours. I have no idea how somebody does that. I'm not kidding. It's like, oh my goodness, what is his stomach made out of? In the fitness center one day, one of the athletes came over and said, how about trying a side plank? Not this, but this. Okay. I might have made it 20 seconds. It was embarrassing. Proud of the normal plank, embarrassed by the side plank, which I had never done, but now I do. Do you know why I do it? Because that little exercise revealed to me that I need help in that area. Because that's what trials and tests do. They expose weakness. And weakness is not meant to bury you, but to focus you on where I've got to grow up. I'm not what I want to be. The 20 seconds reveals it. But now that's a regular part of the exercise in an effort to strengthen the weak area. So what a Christian does when trouble comes is they see it for what it is, an opportunity to learn whether they have faith or where their faith needs to be strengthened. I got to grow. I will tell you that before Parker's illness, I served. That's what pastors do. That's what Christians do. You help when people need service. What I now can tell you is I am a servant. And there is a difference. Serving means that's something I should do, therefore I go do it. It's sacrificial. It's all the things that service can be. But a servant is somebody who wants to do it. It's not a choice. It's who I am. I'm going to argue that the many months and years of challenge with my son has changed who I am, let alone who he is. Suffering does that to you. If you cooperate with God, it'll change you. And that's what it's designed to do. Because it says in this text that it's an exercise to strengthen you. See the word produces? The word produces is a tense of a verb, which means it always produces this. It always has the potential to strengthen you. It produces. It's a passive verb, which means you're not making yourself strong. The struggle and the effort, the trial, will make you strong. It's an exercise to strengthen you. Oh, it's hard. But what it is the best trainer, God, making you better. And it's an exercise specific, custom-made for you. My exercise, I've described to you. Your exercise is your trial that is governed by God to produce strength in you. It produces endurance. The word endurance, meno, to abide, hupo, under. You have the ability to stay under the weight. Using the illustration of the fitness center, a bench press, you're under the weight. The longer you can stay under the weight, the stronger you are. The greater the weight, the longer you can stay under it, the stronger you are. As a matter of fact, the goal of an exercise like that is to do 9 repetitions and not be able to do the 10th one. Because the harder it is and the weaker you are, the stronger you become when you stay with it. If you ever do a bench press, I'm assuming most of you at least know what that is. The first 9 repetitions weaken that muscle group, and then you have a buddy on the bar. He holds his 2 fingers under the bar. He acts like he's going to help you, and he says, at least my lifting partner says, come on, Alice, you can do this. My name is not Alice. And that's a girl's name. And I'm quite comfortable saying I don't want to be a girl. I'm a boy. And I want to do what boys do. And so you can do this. Keep pushing. And the whole goal, everything is wobbly and it's hard and you want to quit, but he's helping you, he says. He's calling you names to motivate you because he knows what you need to know. The hardest exercise is the most important one. That's the one that strengthens you. And so what you need to know is when the trial is hard, it is purposed not just to reveal, but to strengthen. So that you endure more, you can lift more weight, you can carry a greater burden, you become stronger in your faith, your capacity. So the first thing you need to think about is that this trial is an opportunity, not just a difficulty. If I'm visiting you in the hospital, along with the sympathy, if I was with Tom at the appropriate time, certainly initially it's going to be, man, I'm sorry. This is hard. But somewhere along the line, I will say to Tom, if I'm visiting, Tom, don't waste this. This is not about how fast you get through it. This is about how you cooperate with God in order to get strong because of it. Don't waste a trial. You know why? Because you get to repeat them. Because they are purposed by the master trainer, the best trainer, to make you better. Because that's what verse 4 goes on to say. Let endurance. Let is a verb which means it's a choice you make. Let means you exercise your will to stay under the weight of difficulty so you get stronger. Let endurance have its perfect work. Let it come to a perfect result. It's purposed. He's going to talk about the purpose so that you can be whole, complete, lacking in nothing. The word whole has to do with mature, teleos, you finished. Well, what is the finish for a Christian? Christ-likeness. You want to become like Christ? Let the trouble do its work so it can result in this goal of God through your trouble to make you like his favorite son. Whole, finished, mature, like Christ. The word complete is a word used of animals. I spoke of it today in Malachi, unblemished. Without defects. It was used of sacrificial animals that if they were whole, they were unblemished, they were perfect in all their parts. So not only am I my trouble, is it designed by God when it's perfected, when it's finished, when it does what God designed it to do, I'm going to be like Christ and I'm going to be unblemished as a worship offering. I will have greater maturity and I will have higher quality. No impurities and no immaturities. Whole, complete, and the words lacking nothing is a reference to no deficiencies. For what? The mission for which I was created by God to fulfill in my life. It's a practical word. I have enough assets in order to accomplish the purpose for which God has intended me. No immaturities, no impurities, and no deficiencies. Let it do what it does so you can be the best you could possibly be, because trouble is essential to that, which is why God allows it. It's why God ordains it. Now, I don't know what your favorite thing is to do or to be. I don't know what dream you have. Man, if I could if I could study this, if I could be trained in this, it would be the best. For me, it's driving a car fast in competition. My son asked me, what would you want to be if you're not a preacher? A race car driver, and a good one. You pick your thing. But imagine the best at what you want to be, calling your cell phone tonight. Max Verstappen is the guy I'm going to talk about. He just won the F1 race in Canada today. He's the best driver in the world for F1, which is the highest level of auto racing. It's not my favorite form, but it is the highest level. And Max is the best in the world. 3-time world champion on his way to his 4th. I don't know Max. I just know he's the best. Imagine picking up the cell phone and I hear the voice, and he's Dutch, so I know his voice. I heard it as he celebrated his victory today in Canada. And he says, Harry, I've got a proposition for you. I've got a driving school in Europe, and I want you to come join me, and I want to train you. I'm at the hotel at the South Lake Town Center, and I get that call. He said, now listen, it's going to be hard. I train hard. You're going to sweat and you're going to hurt. But I promise that if you'll do what I'm asking you to do and you endure that challenge, that test, that academy of driving, you'll be as good as you can possibly be. You'll be world class. Now, in my analogy, if I got that call, this would happen. Honey, I'm not going to Tennessee. I'm going to Europe. When you go to God's fitness center, you have the master trainer say, I've built a custom exercise just for you. You walk into the fitness center and it's got cables and attachments and things you don't understand. But what you do know is this is designed for you. And what James says is the reason you find joy at this kind of a level is because you get that. You get that this is a tool to refine you, not just an exercise to strengthen you or a test to reveal a reality about you. This is actually a tool to refine you, to make you like Christ, to make you a worship offering, to make you effective in the ways you were designed to be effective. This is your training exercise. And it consists of what the master trainer has designed for you. It's not just a random tick bite. It's not just, hey, I'm in the South in a part of the country where people don't even know how to diagnose this. This is God using a custom-made challenge to grow a family to be like his son, so that this family can worship in ways that otherwise they'd be defective, so that this family has assets that enable them to fulfill divine purposes for his glory. My mission, Parker's mission, my family's mission. This is an essential exercise for that, which is why you let it do what it does. You don't try to escape it. You engage it. You don't say, take the weight off of me, I'm done. No, this is, I'm pushing. Because the whole purpose of this is to make me strong, and I get it, and I'm doing it. I'm doing this, even though it hurts. I'm doing this not because it's easy. I'm doing this because it changes my life. It's making me a better man. It's making me a better husband. It's making me a better Christian. It's making me what I was built to become. John MacArthur said to Parker, Parker, you're in the seminary of suffering. I'm a witness to that. I wish it was a 4-year program online. It's not. But I'll tell you what, he's a different son. He's 28 years, but he's 75 years in terms of the way he thinks and works and walks. He's a better husband than his father is, and I'm 42 years in as of this past week, and I'm better than I was. I'm just not as good as he is. Because what suffering does when you cooperate with God is it transforms you in the ways that matter the most. It is not, why, God? Why did you let this happen? Well, the book of Job teaches you don't know what's really going on. You know, 40-some chapters of Job, and Job never learned what was going on. Satan said, let me take this away, won't glorify you. Let me take more away, his health. He never knew that. You may never know that kind of why God sent you on this particular path, but I'll tell you what you can know, the other why, which is what he's doing. Count it all joy because he's doing a good thing that he has deemed the best exercise to develop your heart in the ways that matter the most. You got to see it for what it is. Otherwise, you'll miss out. Otherwise, you'll complain. And one of the patterns of life, at least in temptations of life, is to passively resign yourself, like this is just my life and I'm going to endure it, i.e. survive it, or I'm going to frustratingly complain about it. This is, I'm not passive, I'm active. I'm engaging, not disengaging. I'm not trying to mute the pain, I'm trying to exercise effort despite the pain. Because I know what it is, and I want what it is. It wasn't Max who called, it was God who called. Because being the best race car driver in the world isn't as valuable as being the best like Christ person I can be. Can you say amen to that? That's what it is. Turn over to 2nd. Oh, one more thing. I want to argue verse 1, it's also a platform to proclaim the gospel. The diaspora, the persecuted Christians, they're not traveling. Oh, I think I'll head off to Turkey and Asia Minor. I'm driven out of Jerusalem because I'm at risk. But I am sown like seed through the persecution to bear the good news of the gospel that other people need to hear. So here's what else your trouble is, a platform to proclaim the good news. Because people like me will listen to people like me. Soon as people find out that my life looks like it looks and the challenges are what they are, they're now receptive to my voice. I'm not the preacher who just does the religious stuff. In the struggles of life that you have, as you navigate them, you will become a credible testimony to someone who struggles like you do. You'll have a voice if you have a testimony. You're the child without the parents who get along. You're in the home that's not working. You're in the circumstances that are hard. And you weather those circumstances in a constructive way. And now you have a testimony that you can talk to people. I know what it feels like to almost die. That's Tom's new testimony. My testimony is I know what it's like to be a caregiver. I feel like I'm in a marathon with no end line. I don't know how many mile markers I'm in. All I know is I just got to keep running. You may live my life, and I can relate to that, and you can relate to me. That's what your trouble also does. And the comfort you receive, the hope you get from God, 2 Corinthians chapter 1, you're not only the recipient of it, you're the dispenser of hope to somebody who needs it. Hey, I've been there. That's what you can say. Hey, I know that God can help you because he's helped me. It is a platform for proclaiming good news and hope and help. And it's your platform. It's not my platform, it's your platform. It's how God is shaping your testimony, life, and influence in a way that allows others to experience what they need. And you're the credible voice because you have a testimony. Hey, you've gone through, you've lost a child. You've gone through difficult days. You've struggled in your marriage. You've had somebody betray you at levels that are hard to describe. Don't underestimate in the eternal plan of God the capacity for not good to work for good. Can you say amen again? These are convictions that allow, that's why you consider it joy. Otherwise, you'll never consider it joy. And you'll never grow. Because this is a pathway to maturity. Turn over to 2 Corinthians chapter 12. I want to plug a couple of things in because this is what you need to see your trouble as: a test to reveal, an exercise to strengthen, a tool to refine you, a time to reach the lost, a platform for proclaiming truth. Number five, it's a stage to display God and His power and His capacity. You know this passage, so I won't unpack all of its details, but this is Paul struggling and he's begging, God, I need relief. It was a purpose struggle because it says, verse 7, 2 Corinthians 12, because of the surpassing greatness of the revelations, whatever had happened in his life that God had revealed to him, for this reason, to keep me from exalting myself. God, there was given me a thorn in the flesh, an angelos of Satan, to torment me. The word torment is a strong word. It's just torture and painful. All to keep me from exalting myself. Your trouble is always, however painful, designed for a purpose to make you better. He's saying it was given to me. He knew why. So he wouldn't be full of pride because of the revelation, the success, the exaltation that would be prone to him because of what he had learned. Verse 8, concerning this, I implored, also a strong, I begged. Some of you have begged. He begged. Concerning this, I implored the Lord three times that it might leave me. I know how to pray. I've leveraged that prayer. I've asked hard. I've begged. This hurts. And this is what I heard. Verse 9. And he has said to me, my grace, my favor, support, and help, my grace is sufficient for you. Sufficient is, it's all you need. You don't need any more than that. You don't need relief from this. You need what I will give you, and that's sufficient. My grace is sufficient for you. Now watch this. For power, that's the dynamite word I talked about this morning, is made perfect in your weakness. Teleos, it reaches its highest expression. Whatever my power is, it's amplified to the highest level when you are astheneo, weak. You have nothing. When you have nothing, I'm going to put on a display of my something. Because on the stage of your weakness is where I reveal my greatness. Because my trial is not just a stage or a platform to proclaim truth to those who need the hope I have, but a stage for the glory of God to be on display in ways that otherwise I would never see. And it's a table upon which I can taste the richness of God. Look at verse 10. Therefore, in other words, he gets it. He says, the power of Christ is going to work in me. It's going to dwell in me so that the power of Christ may dwell in me. Therefore, I am well content. Do you see well content? I accept it. I embrace it. I am well content with weaknesses. I'm well content with the insults. I'm well content with the distresses. I'm well content with the persecutions, with the difficulties. For Christ's sake, for when I am weak, I am strong. I'm going to glory in my weakness. The end of verse 9. Most gladly, therefore, I would rather boast about my weakness so that the power of Christ can dwell in me. I not only accept it and embrace it, I'm boasting. You know why? Because I taste God. There are spaces and places where you don't taste God, and one of those places for this is not on the mountaintop, it's in the valley. It's about knowing God better, experiencing realities about God that otherwise I couldn't experience. Accept it, welcome it, embrace it, celebrate it, stay with it. And you need to see yourself for who you are. Inadequate. Not finished yet. Notice what Go back to James, and we'll wrap this up. So that's how you need to see it. This is how you need to see yourself. Because success in trouble is seeing yourself for who you are. And who am I? I'm not finished yet. And I'm inadequate. I'm not finished, and I am not able to cooperate with God or succeed in trial without help. I'm an unfinished product, I admit that. Secondly, I'm also unable to succeed without divine help, which is why James says in verse 5, "But if any of you lacks wisdom." Verse 5, everybody knows it, but it goes with the first three verses of this section. Verse 5 says, but if. If is a conditional clause, right? I might have wisdom, I might not have wisdom. That's how you could read it. This is a first-class Greek condition. It is not meant to say, I might not have wisdom. It's an emphatic way of saying, I don't have wisdom. If I said to you, since I'm a man, treat me like a man, or if I'm a man, treat me like a man, I am not saying Harry is gender confused. I'm saying, since I'm a man, treat me like one. It's what we saw in Malachi chapter 1. God says, if I'm a father, where is my honor? He's not saying I might not be a father. He's saying, since I'm a father, where is my honor? It's an emphatic statement. A first-class Greek condition says, this is, since you lack wisdom. Lack is destitute. The word lack is no wisdom cans in your cupboard. You have nothing necessary to cooperate with God in the trouble you're in. You lack that. Therefore, you need help from God in order to get what you need to have. Wisdom is the ingredient you need. Wisdom is knowing what to do and how to do it. Wisdom is seeing something from God's perspective. You're in the reality of life and you don't know what to do. I've never been where I am now. I need what I don't have. Perspective. Overhead perspective. God's view. Proverbs 2:6. God provides wisdom. Proverbs chapter 8. Wisdom calls out from above. Where the paths meet. The crossroads of life. I don't know whether I go left. I don't know whether to go to that doctor. I don't know how to deal with my issues. I don't have knowledge that I need. I get that from God. Since you lack wisdom, ask of God. Because God has perspective I do not have in order to do the exercise that my trial represents. When growing up, we would go to Pizza Hut. Those pan pizzas were attractive to me and to my family at that time. And while you're waiting for your pizza to be made at Pizza Hut, there was a little deal on the table, a placemat and some crowns, and your children, my children, can do the stuff, the activities, tic-tac-toe and mazes and all kinds of things. And the mazes was interesting. Watch a child do a maze. They make a lot of mistakes. But as an adult, you can do the maze. And you can do the maze because of the perspective you have. You can just simply say, this is where I begin, that's where I want to go. I kind of see where the roadblocks are, and I can flawlessly do the Pizza Hut maze because of my perspective. In Destin, Florida, there is a real maze. 10 or 12 foot high walls on an acre. I would take my staff to Destin for a staff retreat, and we would go to the maze at least once. You pay money to go in to frustrate yourself. We competed. First one to the end wins. Well, it's hard when you don't have an overview. You're in it. So you have endless turns that look like they're possible, but in fact, they're not the right turn. So you have to return. Now, I was competitive for a while, and then I changed my strategy. They have these towers where spectators can watch the frustration. And in one of those towers was my senior adults pastor, Drew. Partway through my frustration, I looked up to the tower and I said, Drew, guide me. He hesitated because he knows that's not fair, but I threatened him. And Drew helped me through the maze. And it was quite easy because he could see what I couldn't see. And it was a turn-by-turn success story. Let me tell you what wisdom is. God's in the tower. And it's turn by turn, step by step. It's not all the steps, it's the next step. What do you lack? That. What do you need? That. What do you have? None of that. But verse 5, this is seeing God for who he is, says, but since you lack wisdom, ask of God. The asking is a present tense verb. Ask and keep asking. Why? Because it's a turn by turn. Keep asking God, and here's what you need to know about God. He gives to all generously. The word give is a present tense, always true, never not true. God always gives. He's an eternal giver. And how does he give? Generously. I don't know if you have Grand Panda around here, do you? You know what that is? Chinese restaurant? No? Fast food? It must be a California thing. When you go to some restaurants and you order something and they count the pieces, I don't like that. What I like is my grandmother's helping. Mammy, can I have some more of that? Oh yeah, big scoop. How much do you want? Do you know what this is? The Greek word aplos is generously and heaping. It's not the fast food where we're counting the shrimp. Hey, how much do you want? And how much do you need? That's how much I'm going to give. And then some. God is like that. He is an eternal giver. He is a generous giver. And he is not a shamer. He doesn't bring reproach on you. He doesn't make you feel small because you don't know. He's already told you you don't know. You know you don't know. And you're saying, God, I need it. And he's happy to give it. Because God is that kind of God. He uses not good to make you the better person, the best you can be. He's the best at doing the best. And he supplies every asset you need to get where he wants you to go, turn by turn. Because he is the good giver. Chapter 1, verse 17, every good thing given. Do you see that? Every good thing given. And every perfect gift is from above. And it comes down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shifting shadow. He has it. Verse 6. He'll give it. It'll be given to him if he asks God. Verse 6, but he must ask in faith. Keep asking and keep believing. Believing what? I need it. He has it. He will give it. It is believing prayer that accesses a giving God. He goes on to say, without doubting, double-minded, maybe he will, maybe he won't. For the one who doubts is like the surf of the sea, driven and tossed. The imagery's clear. You're all over the place. I trust him. I don't trust him. My circumstances create a situation where I want out. I don't know. I'm losing my confidence. That person who's driven and tossed by unbelief, the bellows of my uncertainty just disturb me. For that man, look at verse 7, for that man ought not to expect that he'll receive anything from the Lord because he's a double-minded man and he's unstable in all of his ways. The absence of believing prayer forfeits the God who gives, giving what I desperately need. I trust you. I need direction. I need provision. I don't know how to do this. I know you do. And I'm waiting and I'm listening. And I don't have to threaten you with your job because you want to tell me where to go. The key to success as a Christian is to accept it, welcome it. It's a reasonable joy. It's not irrational. If you know what it is, you know what you need, and you know what he has, if you'll cooperate. Every person I talk to in trouble, I will always say, cooperate with God. A good God does good things in the hardest of places. Don't miss this opportunity. Can you say amen one more time? Long day, long sermon, but I'll guarantee you, if you heard it and you live it, it'll not only make you a better person, it'll expand your knowledge of God and your influence for the glory of God. It is not a wasted trouble. It is a good God doing a good thing in the hardest of ways. Father, thank you for the opportunity to open your word tonight. It is my prayer that it will be heard, it will be received, and it will result in much ministry, much maturity, and much glory. I pray that the lifestyle and convictions of the hurting Christian will be manifest in their success in dealing with hard things. Grant that grace, encourage that heart, strengthen that conviction, and leverage them in ways that are transformative and impactful. That's my prayer. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen. Thank you.